Welcome back, Question Medicine 2021. This is Andrew Billet down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Another day, another dial, another week, another podcast. You know the deal by now. We're going to get in what I'm getting on. We're talking about what I'm reading about. We're going to break down some articles. If you enjoyed this podcast, if you learn one thing in this podcast, if you take away anything in this podcast, then I encourage you to send this podcast to one friend, just one friend, one person, one individual to help them question medicine. There is no bigger compliment in the entire world than having you pass on this podcast to one other individual. I do truly appreciate it. And with that, without any hesitation, without any reservation, it is good to be back. All right, here we go. Andrew Billet, sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Let's do this thing, shall we? You see, the first article I'm going to talk about is in the journal 2021, Diabetic Medicine. It is titled, SGLT2 Inhibitors and GLP-1 Agonists Administered Without Metformin Compared to Other Glucose-Lowering Drugs in Patients with Type 2 Diabetes Mellitus to Prevent Cardiovascular Events, a Systematic Review. Bum, bum, bum. Well, this article is the article that people are talking about, or they're saying, hey, look at this. You see this article over here? This maybe tells us that we as providers should be using GLP-1 agonists or SGLT2 inhibitors as first line. We don't even need to give metformin anymore. This is so powerful. And I will tell you, those individuals are completely wrong, and I'll tell you why here soon. In this systematic review, they ended up looking at 5 total randomized control trials. These were good randomized control trials. They were all multi-center. They involved many countries. They took place looking at 50,000 patients, but only 10,000 patients did not receive metformin. 10,000 patients is still a lot of individuals, and if done correctly, we can still generate a decent hypothesis or a decent conclusion based on these results or based on this patient population. Now, I will say that 2/3 of the patient population had a history of major adverse cardiovascular events or cardiovascular risk factors, which is complete garbage. There is a huge difference in a cardiovascular risk factor, i.e. diabetes, and someone who's already had a heart attack or stroke. Those are not the same thing. You can't say Mrs. Jones is a 64-year-old female that's already had a stroke is the exact same as Mrs. Jones, who 64-year-old female that has a hemoglobin A1C of 7.2. Those are not the same individuals. When you look at the trials that were included in the systematic review, it is clear that the individuals were very high-risk individuals. For the most part, these were your Hondas, your hypertensive, obese, non-compliant, diabetic, alcoholic patients. They had already had cardiovascular events such as strokes or heart attacks previously prior to being on these medications. That is who was included in these individual trials. The problem with systematic reviews is that you have to look at the studies that were included. You have to look what went into the systematic review. I would let one 25-year-old cut my hair. I would not let 5 5-year-olds cut my hair. You see, it all depends on what goes in to the product. But I digress. So, the mean age was 64 years old. In the intervention group for all of these studies, they either had a GLP-1 agonist or an SGLT2 inhibitor, and then the other group had placebo. If you just read the abstract, you would say, oh, look at this. There is a benefit to major adverse cardiovascular events. But if you go into the paper, you will see when it is broken down that there is no change. Yes, no change. Absolutely zippo, zero, zilcho change. In fact, I think the numbers were actually like 53 in both groups, placebo or the other. There was zero change in fatal events. These major adverse cardiovascular events were benefits in stroke and kind of benefits in heart attack, depending on which one you're looking at. But the non-fatal events, stroke and heart attack, that's the benefit here. Now, don't get me wrong. Those are great outcomes. Those are outcomes my patients care about. Absolutely, 100%. But there needs to be clear distinction that there was no difference in fatal events. And this is a great outcome. This is a great conclusion. This was a great study. This tells us that high-risk individuals, with or without metformin, benefit from these drugs. But I have to ask, did we really think that they wouldn't benefit from these drugs by themselves? I mean, if you are already giving someone metformin and then they benefit from the drug, well then, I would expect that without metformin, they're still going to benefit from the drug. You see, if I give you a drug that I know works to prevent major adverse cardiovascular events, such as metformin, and then I give you another drug on top of that, that other drug on top of that has to be that much better in order to give you any extra gain. If your risk is, I don't know, 50%, and metformin takes you down to a risk of 45%, and then this next drug takes you down to a risk of 43%, that drug taking you down the extra two more percents from 45 to 43, it had to already be a really good drug. This study is not saying that these drugs, these SGLT2 inhibitors or the GLP-1 agonists should be first line. That's not what it's saying. It's saying they work by themselves, but we already should have known that they work by themselves. I guess it's good to know that they work by themselves, I guess, sort of, but that does not mean they should be first line. They're still $500 a month, and metformin should still be first line. And as I reminded you, or as I said in the beginning, these individuals that were enrolled in these trials, when you actually go back to the original trials, are very high-risk individuals. Hypertensive, obese, non-compliant, diabetic, alcoholic. They are, their full gamut, already had a previous event in 50, 60, up to 99% of the individuals in one of the trials already had a previous event. These were high-risk people. So don't just be giving it to your willy-nilly, every single Tom, Buck, Harry, Joe, Sally that walks into your office with type 2 diabetes. It's not for them, but this is for your high-risk individuals, and these are really good drugs, and I guess it's good to know that they work by themselves. Speaking of something that works, or I guess in this situation does not work by itself, what about high-dose vitamin D? Well, that is in JAMA, a paper titled Effect of Single High-Dose Vitamin D3 on Hospital Length of Stay in Patients with Moderate to Severe COVID-19, a Randomized Clinical Trial. Yes, this study in JAMA looked to see, does high-dose vitamin D look to help individuals that are hospitalized because of COVID in this randomized clinical trial of 240 hospitalized patients with moderate to severe COVID-19, a single dose of 200,000 international units. 200,000 international units of vitamin D compared with placebo did not significantly reduce the primary outcome, which was hospital length of stay. It didn't even sort of reduce it. It was 7 in both arms. It was dead on. This 200,000 international units of vitamin D was basically exactly placebo. And you might say to yourself, well, I didn't really expect it to reduce the hospital length of stay, but what about all the other outcomes? And I am glad that you asked, my friend, because the pre-specified secondary outcomes included mortality during the hospitalization, the number of patients admitted to the intensive care unit, the number of patients who required mechanical ventilation. It also looked at the duration of the mechanical ventilation, and it looked at the serum vitamin D levels. And there was one outcome that showed a statistical difference. And I will let you guess which one it is. It is, the increase in the serum vitamin D levels. You see, if you give 200,000, almost a quarter million international units of vitamin D, well then you don't have to worry. There is an increase in the vitamin D level compared to placebo. It's an endpoint that we don't care about. It is frustrating. And why would you even do a trial like this? In fact, I was asked this on Twitter. They said, why did we think that this would work? The answer is because, well, I'll tell you because. Because we believe, we being most people in medicine, that the vitamin D use, or the usage of vitamin D, I should say, is so much stronger. The evidence around it is so much better than it actually is. Because when you actually look at the evidence, vitamin D should really probably not be used for much of anything. The belief around vitamin D is way stronger than the evidence. And if you're willing to enroll 240 patients to either placebo or incredibly high dose vitamin D, you can get a publication in JAMA. And everybody wants a publication in JAMA. I think the vein of my existence is vitamin D. But until these major journals start to say, We're not going to accept your publication anymore. We're done with this. It's over. Vitamin D is in the trash. Every good randomized controlled trial on it doesn't show any benefit over placebo. And when I say not any benefit, I mean it's like up and down the line of no effect. It's not even like, you can kind of squeak it out if you kind of blink your eyes or you kind of squint. You know, then maybe there's just a tilt of benefit. No, there's zero Zippo benefit. Ugh, it is frustrating. And speaking of frustrating, how about patients with acne? Yes, the patients with acne, they are frustrated. And this brings me to the next article, which is titled Diet and Acne, Review of the Evidence from 2009 to 2022. This was in the International Journal of Dermatology. And this brings me to nutrition research. Before I tell you the results, nutrition research is terrible. Why is it terrible, you ask? Because often it relies on recall bias. We say, hey, what did you have this last week? What did you have this last month? How many times would you say that you went out to eat? And people tend to lie. They don't want to disappoint us, the providers, or anyone who's asking the questions. They don't want to look bad. So they tend to underreport bad foods and overreport good foods. They tend to say, well, yeah, I might have had, you know, like probably 10 servings of fruit and vegetables. And they're rounding up from 10 bites of fruit and vegetables. They might say, well, I probably only ate out fast food maybe 3 times this month. And what they're really thinking is, I ate out fast food 3 times in the last week, but you don't really need to know that. I don't want to look bad in this survey, so I'm going to maybe skew my data just a little bit. I'm going to skew my data just a tad. And problems with dermatology literature is, often it's observational based. It's how does it look? Is it cystic or is it not cystic? And sometimes is it cystic is a very clear answer. Yes, it is cystic. Or other times it's not so clear. It kind of is cystic. It looks like it could be cystic in the very near future, but it's not yet. And so which category do you count that in? It's largely observational based and sometimes fraught with bias. Now, let me get off my high horse here. Let me back down from my podium and get on to the results. This study looked at 42 observational studies between 2009 and 2020, and they found that if you had at least 3 servings of dairy milk, whole milk especially, then that would make your acne worse. 3 servings a week, that makes your acne worse. 3 servings a week of whole milk, it makes your acne worse. What else makes your acne worse? Well, fatty, spicy, oily, and fried foods. Yes, and foods that are high in saturated fat. This all makes your acne worse. It makes your acne worse, but how much worse? Well, it, again, is usually based on observational data, but it appears like you need to consume these spicy, oily, fatty, fried foods at least once a day. So a good rule of thumb is try to stay away from spicy, oily, fatty, fried foods every single day. I mean, don't forget to live life, but you should try to stay away from them. You can have them every now and then, but try to stay away from them. And what about chocolate? It doesn't matter whether it's milk chocolate or 100% cocoa. When they looked at the data, it appears that yes, milk chocolate or 100% cocoa chocolate does appear to aggravate the acne. So try to stay away from it, or at least stay away from using it every single day. You can maybe eat a candy bar once a month, but don't eat a candy bar every day. And what about fruits and veggies? Well, fruits and veggies seem to have a protective effect on acne. It seemed to prevent acne. So a good rule of thumb is you should eat more fruits and vegetables. What I'm telling you is this study doesn't really say much of what we shouldn't already be doing. We should tell our patients, you should eat more fruits and vegetables. You should try to stay away from eating fatty, spicy, oily, fried foods every single day of your life. You should also try to stay away from eating chocolate a couple times a week or even daily. You know, don't forget to live. You can have a candy bar once a month, but you should try to stay away from chocolate. And what about whole milk? Sure, you can have a glass of whole milk, but you probably don't need to have one every single day or even 3 times a week. Just every now and then, maybe with your chocolate chip cookie. I don't know what it is, but eat more fruits and vegetables and eat less garbage food. This seems like a really good rule of thumb, whether you do or do not have acne. And this should be easy to remember for everyone, whether you do or do not have a patient with acne. You should tell them to do what you're already going to tell them to do, and that's eat healthier, live healthier. And if your patient comes in concerned about their acne and concerned about their diet, you can share with them exactly what you share with every single patient. Yes, diet does have an effect on your acne. It also has effect on your cardiovascular disease, your high blood pressure. It has effect on everything for the rest of your life. So you can share with them the exact same knowledge. And speaking of knowledge, let's move on to the last article. The last article comes in the BMJ. It is titled Statin Treatment and Muscle Symptoms, a Series of Randomized Placebo-Controlled N-of-1 Trials. One of my top trials from 2020 is the SAMHSA trial. And if you don't know anything about the SAMHSA trial, if you've never heard of the SAMHSA trial before, well, then I'm not going to talk about it now, but you're going to have to tune in in the next couple of weeks when I do talk about the SAMHSA trial. You're going to have to tune in when I do talk about this other N-of-1 trial that occurred and came out in the New England Journal of Medicine back in 2021 that I think is one of the top articles of 2021. But that's neither here nor there. This is now about this study in the BMJ. This study in the BMJ looked at patients stopping statins, or probably stopping statins. You see, often patients stop statins because of muscle aches, muscle pains, just muscle blah. But would they restart the statin if they could? Of course they would. They would do it if we blinded them. They would restart a statin if we blinded them? Yes, that's exactly what I said. In this study published in the BMJ, they took 200 UK patients who were either considering stopping a statin or who had already stopped a statin in the prior 3 years because of muscle aches and muscle complaints, and then they assigned them to 3 2-month treatment periods of atorvastatin and 3 2-month periods of placebo in randomized order for 1 year. So it would look like this. Mrs. Jones, take these pills in this bottle right here for the next 2 months, and then you come back and you get another 2 month pills, and then you come back and get another 2 month pills, and you don't know whether they're giving you 2 months of a placebo or they're giving you 2 months of a statin. And then every single day for 1 year, you log your muscle soreness, your muscle complaints. You don't know whether you're getting a placebo or a atorvastatin. You just know you're taking this pill that looks exactly the same every single month. And then you're logging, how sore are my muscles? On a 1 to 10 scale, how sore are my muscles? And wait for it, the results were the observed mean muscle symptom score on the visual analog scale was lower during statin treatment periods. It wasn't really statistically lower. It was about exactly the same. It was 1.68 versus 1.85. But there was no difference in muscle achiness whether you were getting a statin or a placebo. This is what we like to call the nocebo effect. And I will explain more about the nocebo effect during the 2020 lecture. But I think the big takeaway here is that what we say to our patients actually holds weight. If we tell our patients, you're going to take this drug called a statin, and I remind you that a statin is the only evidence-based answer for primary prevention for hyperlipidemia. The only primary prevention drug we have. And I can say that with 100% certainty. And as stated in the VA guidelines, which I can also say with a 100% certainty because I help write them, was if your patient has a problem taking a statin, you should do a washout period. Stop. Just, okay, we're not going to give you a statin anymore. Give them a month and then either restart the exact same statin or you can try a different statin if you want to. But it doesn't really matter which one when you start because most people can tolerate if you resume statin therapy. The reason that they can tolerate if you resume statin therapy is because most of these muscle ache pains, blah, would have happened with placebo. It didn't matter that the patient was getting a statin. They just woke up achy one day because they were working in their garden and they say, well, this muscle ache must be from the statin. No, my friends. It would have happened with the placebo. It does happen with the placebo. That's the amazing thing. Statin therapy, yes, we like to tell patients that, oh, this can cause muscle aches and pains. And yes, for some patients, the one out of 10,000, there are going to be individuals that cannot take them. 100%, I guarantee. I don't disagree with that. But for a majority of patients, I would say we shouldn't even tell them anymore. Because for a majority of patients, there is no difference over placebo. And when there's no difference over placebo, we don't need to tell them about it because there's no difference over placebo. It is frustrating. One of the cool things I do like about this article is that at the end of the trial, the authors told the patients which group they were in. normally, when you're in a trial, when you're a patient in a trial, you're doing it for the good of medicine. You don't know whether you got the active drug, the placebo drug. You don't know the results. You know nothing. You are completely blinded to any outcome or results. You are doing it for the good of science, for the good of medicine. But nearly 90% of the patients that found out what group they were in, they said it was helpful. They said, oh, wow, I didn't realize that this whole time I thought that I was allergic to statins, and turns out I'm just allergic to placebos. I'm allergic to waking up and my muscles get sore. It turns out I'm just kind of older now and my muscles aren't what they used to be. And 2/3 of the patients resumed their statin therapy. And when statins are the only, I can't stress this enough, the only evidence-based answer for primary prevention. There is no other evidence-based answer for primary prevention. If you're giving any other evidence-based answer for primary prevention, you are doing your patient a disservice either to their wallet, to the fact that they have to take a pill every day. You're doing a disservice. The only evidence-based answer to primary prevention is a statin. That is it. That is it. That is 100% it. It is vitally important that patients who are eligible for these drugs are on these drugs. And with that, I have ranted on long enough. So let's wrap this podcast up and let's review the articles I've talked about today before this ship sets sail in a sea of evidence. Okay, from the top, it was the SGLT2 inhibitors and the GLP-1 agonists. They work by themselves without metformin. But I ask you, did we actually think that they wouldn't work by themselves? Did we actually think that they wouldn't prevent cardiovascular events by themselves? I kind of assumed that they would anyways, but let's not forget, they're still $500 a month. Let's not forget, the patients enrolled in the trials were still super high risk. The hypertensive, obese, non-compliant, diabetic, alcoholic, they had it all going on. This does not mean, 100% does not mean that the GLP-1 agonist or the SGLT2 inhibitor should be first line. They should not be first line. Even in your high risk population, they should not be first line. These should still be second-line drugs. Moving on to the next article was high-dose vitamin D. 200,000 international units of vitamin D. Almost 250,000 international units of vitamin D. And guess what? It did nothing. Diddly squat. Not a darn thing other than raise your vitamin D level, in case you had any doubt that getting 200,000 international units of vitamin D wouldn't raise your vitamin D level. Have no fear. It does raise the serum level of your vitamin D. And what about DDD diet? Diet and acne. What about your diet and acne? Well, it does appear that diet does affect your acne. It affects your acne a lot. But what foods affect it? Well, milk chocolate or 100% cocoa. Spicy, oily, fatty, high saturated fat diet. Yep, they all affect. Milk, whole milk, more than 3 times a week. Yep, definitely affects your acne. And what about fruits and veggies? It seems to have a protective effect. If your patient comes in, they say, what can I do about my acne? What can I change in my diet? You should tell them exactly what you tell all of your patients. Eat more fruits and veggies. Try to stay away from chocolate if you can. Try to stay away from whole milk more than 3 times a week. And don't every day eat foods that are fatty, spicy, oily, or high in saturated fat. It's just a good rule of thumb whether you do or do not have acne. And last but not least, statin therapy and muscle aches. It's a myth, my friends. It is no more than placebo. When we do the trials, we blind people to one arm or the other arm. With placebo or statin, there is no difference. This has come a time, here we are, 2021, that we can all, yes, anyone who's listening to this, and if you listen to this and you learned anything, pass it on to a friend so then they can listen to it, and maybe they will learn something, and maybe they will pass it on to a friend. But here we are, 2021, right now, I can say we should no longer tell patients about muscle aches with statins, because it's no different than placebo. We don't tell them about nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, chest pain, shortness of breath, congestion, headache, blah, 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 all car accidents, all these things that are no different than placebo. We don't. We never, ever, ever say that. So why are we now doing it, or why have we been doing it with muscle aches? I have the answer for you in a future podcast, but we should no longer do it. When you do the trials, there's no difference between muscle aches, between statins, and placebo. We can go ahead and stop telling patients that it causes muscle aches. With that, I will end this podcast as I've ended every single one before it. Wait for the music. And until next time, keep the quest and questioning.